Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU, I am Siegfried, and we're still in pandemic mode, comrades, but we're also still forging ahead, and I'd like to thank you all for listening on what is the third episode I've recorded back in the USSR since returning back in October after quite a lengthy absence. Now, last week on the show, I had a chance to get into some good news for a change. I mean, really good news, namely how the Bolivian people managed to defeat a brutal, unelected, U.S.-backed coup regime after a year of fighting against all the odds and electing a new socialist government by a landslide on October 18th, on the elections on October 18th. You know, and the way I've heard it described by people who have been on the ground, it's like people can breathe again. You know, like commentators, observers of that election, you know, after the results came in, just, you know, millions of downtrodden Bolivians, they can now breathe again. Like, that seems to be the atmosphere in Bolivia right now. You know, after, like, just months and months and months of, like, basically fighting for their lives. and resisting this this brutal government, all the measures it took against the people there, against working class and oppressed people, the indigenous population in particular. So that electoral victory, you know, that after a really long struggle, you know, including like general strikes and all kinds of stuff, you know, that has to be the best news I've heard all year. But it was to be followed up by more good news, interestingly enough. On October 25th, Chilean voters went to the polls to decide whether or not to scrap the undemocratic constitution that military dictator Augusto Pinochet imposed on Chile in the 1980s. And just like in Bolivia, the results were unequivocal. You know, nearly 80% of voters wanted a new constitution. You know, a democratically drafted constitution. It was drafted after extensive consultation with the people, right? That's what they wanted. They wanted a really democratic constitution, not this neoliberal constitution that had been imposed on them by force in the 1980s. You know, overwhelming numbers of voters like wanting this new constitution, you know, like, you know, like 80%. I mean, that's huge. You know, like massive margins there, you know, and last week I mentioned this vote and how important it was in the context of the struggle for democracy in South America and the landslide result of this referendum. It's another blow against the neoliberal capitalist order that the U.S. has long sought to impose on the entire region. Imposed by force on the entire region. I mean, after all, Augusto Pinochet came to power in a U.S.-backed coup in 1973 in Chile and reigned as dictator for the next 20 years, imposing economic austerity on his people at gunpoint, effectively, and leaving a bitter legacy that persists to this day. And it's still going to be a long struggle by left-wing forces before that legacy of capitalist dictatorship, you know, which made Chile one of the most unequal countries on the planet, is undone. You know, it's still going to be a long struggle before that legacy is overcome. And that's not even getting into the legacy of colonialism and genocide against which the Mapuche indigenous nation in Chile is still fighting. You know, the open wounds of Latin America, I mean, they, you know, they go back 500 years, like to the Spanish conquest. And as the struggle of the indigenous majority in Bolivia against a white supremacist coup attests, you know, healing those wounds is not going to be an easy task. It's going to be very, very hard. There is a reason why Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of any country in the Western Hemisphere, you know, the president of Bolivia, before he was overthrown in that coup in 2019, there's a reason why he invoked the name of Tupac Katari, an indigenous leader who fought against the Spanish colonizers centuries ago. There's a reason he invoked that name because that anti-colonial struggle is still ongoing. Only this time the colonizer is based in Washington, D.C., and not in Madrid. And that, of course, brings us to the topic of tonight's show, the current situation in the U.S. of A., the heartland of a global empire with more than 700 military bases spread across every continent and with an armed presence in every corner of the globe. What happens in Washington has global repercussions, and that is why the U.S. elections are such major events from a geopolitical standpoint, you know, not just a domestic one. And from a geopolitical standpoint, the two contenders in this election appear especially unappealing. And I say this because as a non-American who lives outside the U.S., I'm frankly more concerned about U.S. foreign policy than anything else. I'm more concerned about what the U.S. is going to do to other countries, especially those in close proximity to its borders. You know, so including countries in Latin America. And to start with, it's very telling that the CEOs of American arms manufacturers and their investors are confident in their prospects, regardless of who wins the election. You know, this is very striking. They don't really seem to care who wins. In this case, you know, my friend Greg Shupak actually wrote a really great piece in The Nation on this very subject last Friday. And he quotes Dave Calhoun, the CEO of Boeing, who said, quote, "I think both candidates, at least in my view, appear globally oriented and interested in the defense of our country, and I believe they'll support the industries. I don't think we're going to take a position on one being better than the other." End quote. And Greg rightly points out that it was Boeing's Apache helicopters that were responsible for killing civilians in the infamous collateral murder video that Chelsea Manning brought to public attention, years ago, exposing the atrocities being committed in Iraq by the U.S. And so arms giants like Boeing, Raytheon, and Lockheed Martin are directly and indirectly funding both the Trump and the Biden campaigns. And they are absolutely confident that both of them can be counted on to pursue policies favorable to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be backing both sides. They're confident that both sides can be counted on to pursue policies that are of interest to them, that serve their interests. Which, in short, means more aggression, more military aggression, and belligerent actions around the globe, and a policy of military brinkmanship with regard to Russia and China. I mean, pushing the world to the brink of World War III is good for business if you are Boeing. It means more arms sales. It means you can just dump more weapons on, billion-dollar contracts on all these different countries. Because the global atmosphere is so tense and so prone to conflict. And conflict could erupt at any time, right? That's the kind of environment you want as an arms manufacturer, as one of these giant arms manufacturers who, just thrive on, making profits off of killing, basically. But there's a lot of continuity in American elections. I mean, you'll likely have noticed that if you've been around long enough. I mean, the overall policy direction of successive American administrations doesn't shift a whole hell of a lot when you think about it. I mean, everyone thought there was going to be a big sweeping change when Obama took over from George W. Bush at the beginning of 2009. But Obama kept troops in Iraq. He supported Israel in its murderous assault on Gaza. He maintained Guantanamo Bay. He didn't punish anyone for torture. He kept up the war on terror. And he later expanded military operations into Libya and Syria. And there were migrant kids held in cages under Obama, just as there are migrant kids held in cages under Donald Trump, who mainly just expanded on racist anti-immigration policies already in place, or made official what was already being done in practice. The military-industrial complex keeps on rolling. The prison-industrial complex keeps on rolling, regardless of what president is in power. What administration is in power? There's continuity. I mean, while things like Obama's deal with Iran are notable exceptions, American foreign policy has been remarkably consistent and just as remarkably belligerent over time. And this is because these policies serve very powerful interests. These policies of empire and aggression. And always looking for adversaries and always confronting supposed adversaries around the world. I mean, beyond arms contractors, just about every sector of the American capitalist class, from bankers to Silicon Valley, is geared towards empire and global dominance. I mean, even if they don't have direct dealings with the Pentagon, they ultimately rely on a steady flow of cheap resources from the global south and the exploitation of cheap labor in the global south, both of which are guaranteed by American military power and the military power of America's allies and vassals around the world. I mentioned Elon Musk last week and his role in the 2019 Bolivian coup, which he openly supported out of his desire for cheap lithium to fuel his electric car empire, Tesla. And Canadian mining companies like Barrick Gold, exploiting natural resources in countries like Honduras and Indonesia, likewise benefit from American imperial dominance and its ability to put puppet rulers into place who will serve the interests of global capital in the Fortune 500 over and above the needs of their own citizenry. I mean, Honduras in particular is notable for having suffered an American-backed coup back in 2007, which ousted progressive President Manuel Zelaya and led to a series of right-wing governments that basically handed the country to multinational corporations on a silver platter, while unleashing death squads against indigenous land defenders and environmental activists like Berta Cáceres. This coup, like the 2019 coup in Bolivia, was also supported by the government of Canada. It should come as no surprise that large percentages of the Latin American migrants arriving at the southern border of the U.S. in recent years are fleeing from Honduras in a refugee crisis of America's own making. And now we have all these desperate kids locked up in concentration camps after being forcibly separated from their parents. You know, this is a result of empire. You know, this is empire, brothers and sisters. And it rarely enters into American political discourse. I mean, even Bernie Sanders and AOC rarely talk about it. And when they do, they rarely make the necessary connections between things like the migrant crisis and the imperialist policies of successive administrations going back decades now. There's so much that goes unstated, even on the left. When you have a country based on plunder, firstly of stolen indigenous lands and then of other countries throughout the world, there are many illusions that must be maintained if the status quo is to be maintained. I think it was Stokely Carmichael who said that America is the most successfully repressed country in the world because so many of its people believe its omnipresent propaganda with all their hearts. I mean, even progressives are lulled into saying that propaganda is only something that America's supposed enemies do, and that America is a free country with some problems, you know, with some problems that ultimately can be worked out and set straight. I mean, even settler colonialism and systemic racism are misrepresented as the attitude problems of certain bad apples, rather than the foundational features of the American state going back to the very beginning. You know, and this is even when black and brown people are regularly being killed by cops and railroaded into prisons, you know, on a massive scale. But of course, it's becoming harder and harder to maintain these illusions amidst the pandemic, you know, with a death toll of more than 225,000 in the United States and growing, you know, the highest death toll of any country in the world. And the idea that Joe Biden, who has said again and again that he rejects every single policy proposal that Bernie Sanders ever advanced, is going to come in and fix everything, is just unbelievable. It won't happen. And people know this. As much as people want Trump gone, they know that Biden really isn't going to ease their pain. And so they hold their noses while voting for the lesser of two evils. Right, that's really what's going on here. And I've just heard this again and again. I mean, people don't like Biden, but they pretty much have no choice. That's the only reason they're basically voting for him. But they don't think like he's going to actually do anything, and he probably won't. You know, he is beholden to those interests, those elite interests, those entrenched interests, those capitalist interests, those imperial interests, and he's going to keep them going. He's not a people's guy. He's not a guy who like looks out for like oppressed people or like downtrodden people, working class people. He's not about them. He's not there to serve them. And fundamentally, brothers and sisters, and I think this is very, very clear after what happened with the Bernie Sanders campaign, there is never going to be a socialist America. Just straight up, I'm going to say that. There is never going to be such a thing as a socialist America, a socialist United States. The idea that the stars and stripes can be redeemed is patently ridiculous at this point. If socialism really triumphed, if a socialist revolution really succeeded in this part of the world, America would effectively cease to exist. And a new nation, a new socialist nation, would have to emerge in its place. Which wouldn't be America, that wouldn't be the United States, it would be a new nation. Built on new foundations. And the same goes for Canada. You cannot build a new society on like rotten foundations of empire, colonial violence, and genocide. You'll have to demolish the old house and put down new foundations. It's the only way. And, you know, maybe I'm out of step with a lot of white leftists when I say this, but I don't really care. You know, seeing that I try to take my cue from indigenous land defenders who do not recognize the authority of the capitalist settler state. I'm not here to save Canada or America, you know, as a communist here. I'm not here to save that. I'm here to build something new. To do my part in building something new, something beyond this. You know, overcoming the settler state, overcoming settler colonialism, building something new, playing a role in building something new. If there's ever going to be justice in this land, if systemic oppression is going to be overcome and broken down, we're going to have to start building a new foundation. You know, a new society. And this time we're not going to start from white supremacy, but from the principles of internationalism and solidarity between peoples. This is the only path to a livable future. And that needs to be emphasized. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. We'll be right back. Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Handsome Furs with Serve the People. You know, great song there. And seeing we were talking about the U.S. election before, I think it would be appropriate right now to cut to progressive scholar Michael Parenti and his analysis of the role of the American presidency in the American and the global capitalist system. So I'm going to cut to that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The authors of American government textbooks like to point out that the president plays many roles. He has many roles. He's not only chief executive, we hear, but he's also the leader of his party. He's a chief legislator in the sense that he proposes a legislative program. He's in the policy process. And he's also commander-in-chief. And he's also the head of state, the way sort of the Queen of England is, you see. He's an embodiment. When I wrote my American government textbook, Democracy for the Few, with a sort of anti-textbook, actually, I said, there's another role that he has, which none of these other books have mentioned. He's the guardian and representative of capitalism. He's the embodiment of the executive-centered state system that defends American corporate interests at home and abroad. I'm quoting from one of my favorite authors right now, as a matter of fact. Every modern president has had occasion to praise the free enterprise system and denounce collectivist alternatives. William Shannon's description of President Ford, back when William Shannon used to criticize conservatism, President Ford, it could easily apply to any number of other presidents, quote, he follows the judgment of the major international oil companies on oil problems in the same way that he amiably heeds the advice of other big businesses on the problems that interest them. He is a solid believer in the business ideology of rugged individualism, free markets, and price competition, virtues that exist more clearly in his mind than they do in the practices of the international oil industry, unquote. The president is, I maintain, the top salesman of the system. He conjures up reassuring images about the State of the Union. Nixon, America is number one. Reagan, America is standing tall. America is the greatest. This is what Ronald Reagan was saying to a nation with 35 million citizens living below the poverty level, millions unemployed, hundreds of thousands homeless, a record trade deficit, and a runaway national debt. Whether Democratic or Republican, liberal or conservative, the president tends to treat capitalist interests as synonymous with the nation's well-being. Presidents greet the accumulation of wealth as a manifestation of a healthy national economy, regardless of how that wealth is applied or distributed or how, what's it being used for. I mean, what's this wealth being used for? Is it being used to make more yachts? Or is it being used for housing for working people? Ronald Reagan, quote, America will achieve new heights spurred on by freedom and the profit motive. Ronald Reagan, I want America always to be a country where someone can become a millionaire. Ronald Clinton. Ronald Clinton on the McNeil Lair. Quote, this is a free enterprise country, said President Clinton. I want to create more millionaires in my presidency than Bush and Quayle did. What an ambition. What a goal. He didn't say that during the campaign. During the campaign, he was Jesse Jackson. When he got into office and started setting up, he was Jimmy Carter. Now he's Ronald Reagan. Now he wants to outdo Bush and Quayle. Presidents describe the overseas investments of giant corporations as U.S. interests. Those giant interests are called U.S. interests abroad to be defended at all costs, certainly at great cost to the U.S. populace. A president's primary commitment abroad is not to democracy, but to free market capitalism. And they are beginning to say that a little more candidly. It's probably not easy for a president to remain keenly aware of the suffering and the travails and the deprivations endured by the great mass of people throughout the world, including a lot of ordinary working people in this country. I mean, the president lives like a monarch, a potentate, in utter opulence. He lives in a rent-free, 132-room mansion called the White House, set on an 18-acre estate with a personal domestic staff of about 100 people, including 7 butlers and 5 full-time florists, a well-stocked wine cellar, tennis courts, a private movie room, a private gymnasium, a private bowling alley. Lyndon Johnson must have put that one in. And a heated outdoor swimming pool. And this is a guy who's got to pose as a man of the people who's concerned about ordinary folk. In addition, the president has the free services of a private physician, including all those presidents who didn't want people to have health insurance and socialized medicine, and that would be too much and all that. They should pay for their own medical care. They all had free medical care themselves. See, it's different when you have it for yourself. You understand? It's different. That's what Norman Bradbury is pointing out. It's you out there sacrificing for the country, but I get my family out from downwind. You preach one thing out there, and you do something else. The president also has 12 chauffeured limousines, numerous helicopters and jets, including Air Force One, and he has access to the imperial luxuries of Camp David and other country retreats, free vacations, a huge expense allowance, and then for those very few things he must pay for out of his own pocket, he gets a salary of $200,000 a year. Journalists and political scientists used to like to write, it was a real fad back in the late 50s, early 60s, I used to describe the presidency as a man-killing job. Well, you know, closer investigation shows that presidents actually probably work a shorter day than the average working man or woman who really has to put in hours. That presidents take more vacations and they live far better and longer than the average American male, including the average middle-class white male. And after leaving office, by the way, they continue to feed off the public trough. 5 ex-presidents we have now, all of them multimillionaires, yet each one receives from $500,000 to $700,000 in annual pensions, office space, staff, and travel expenses, along with full-time Secret Service protection that costs $5 million for each of them. I mean, $5 million for Gerry Ford? Well, is the president too powerful or not powerful enough? Actually, I think both the liberals and conservatives are consistent in both those inconsistent charges. Presidents are not powerful enough when working with mass interests, working for mass interests, I should say, and opposing corporate and financial interests. But the president is very powerful when engaging in the converse, when he's working for corporate interests, and when he's working against mass interests. The president is very powerful when he's exercising state power. That whole theory, by the way, when liberals started talking about the imperial presidency, the Republicans hadn't gotten elected yet. There wasn't any Nixon or Ford or Reagan in yet. They were already talking about LBJ, and they were talking about Vietnam. And it occurs to them how irresponsive, unaccountable this power was, as millions of people were saying, get out of this war. And this war, these guys were still going ahead and doing it. And they're saying, my God, this president is an autocrat in a way. Well, on certain kinds of issues, and the closer he is to the state, he is. He suddenly understands that the power of that office was not imbued in the office. The power of that office was there as long as that office served powerful interests. By the way, this is true of Clinton also, what I've just said. What you have here is a structuralist argument. This is the argument of the structuralist versus the functionalist. The structuralists say that the system prefigures what the people can do who go into it. And the functionalists say, no, the people who go in can make a difference. And it's all the question of which guy's in there. Is it a good guy or a bad guy? If it's a good guy, we'll get good policy. If it's a bad guy, we'll get bad policy. The structuralist says that regardless whether it's Tory or Labor, there must still be basic concessions and provisions to those who control the jobs, investments, and market forces, who control the other levers of the state. The structuralist argument is essentially correct, but it's over-applied. Because it's one thing to say that the structure is an inescapable, overriding social formation that sets fundamental limits, and it's another thing to say that the structure predetermines all policy outcomes all the time. You can't say that. You get too abstracted, too mystical. I mean, Reagan and Thatcher demonstrated that it does make a difference who's elected. So the functionalists do have a point, that within certain parameters, it does make a difference who's on the Supreme Court, who staffs the departments, who makes decisions in the regulatory agencies and in Congress. It does make a difference. It determines what laws are passed and how they're enforced or how they're ignored.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU, that was Killing Joke with their song Democracy. And we don't know what the hell is going to happen on election day in America. I mean, some people are predicting like the worst, you know, some people are predicting mass unrest, some people are predicting like a new civil war. But regardless of the outcome of this election, really, the answers are going to come from the working class and the downtrodden and the oppressed. Oppressed peoples, colonized peoples, who are going to continue struggling for justice going forward. And so I think it's kind of appropriate that I round out the show with a talk by a former Black Panther, Glenn Ford, Glenn Ford's the executive director of the Black Agenda Report, which is a very great progressive black-led media organization in the U.S. And in this talk he gives, he basically goes through the history of black radicalism, the social justice movement, and the anti-war movement. All these things are going to be crucial going forward as we struggle for a just future, for a humane future, a livable future. So I want to round out the show with that. So this is Glenn Ford, the Black Agenda Report. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
The Black Alliance for Peace sees the anti-war movement and the social justice movement as inseparable. There can be no peace without justice,
right,
and no justice in the absence of peace.
Right.
We're here on the anniversary of the day the world turned,
yes,
in Black America, the day they killed Dr. King. On the day before that cataclysmic event in April of 1968, I was a young paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division. I was out in the field doing exercises with my unit, the 82nd Airborne Division, in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. My unit's duty on that day was to guard the division's headquarters tents. All that Wednesday, company commanders and executive officers filed into those tents, and they were studying maps of Washington, D.C., so that the division would know how to deploy its troops if we had to occupy the city in case of an insurrection. The very next day, on Thursday, Dr. King was killed, and we were airlifted to Washington to pacify the city. That city was burning, as were 100 other cities across the country. I didn't know what the commanding officers thought their mission was, but the black soldiers of the 82nd Airborne Division knew what our assignment had to be. As far as we were concerned, our mission came from Dr. King and from Malcolm.
That's right.
Just 2 years before. At that time, the 82nd Airborne Division was 60% black.
Yes.
And the black troops on that day were united in the mission of ensuring that the white soldiers didn't harm one head in Washington, D.C. All of us were aware of what had happened in Newark, New Jersey just a year before. That's when a lily white unit of the National Guard was called in to put down a 4-day rebellion,
right,
against police brutality,
that's
in Newark.
Right.
The guardsmen rode up and down Springfield Avenue, that's a major thoroughfare in Black Newark, and they were shooting off their weapons like drunken cowboys. They made special targets of the stores that displayed Soul Brother or Black-owned signs. 26 brothers and sisters and children were killed in Newark. The black troops of the 82nd Airborne Division swore that the racist occupation of Newark would not be repeated on our watch, not in D.C., after they had killed Dr. King. And nobody was harmed by the occupying 82nd Airborne Division in 1968, because the black soldiers would not stand for it. And that is not just an anecdote, brothers and sisters. That was the beginning of the end of the draft in the United States. The U.S. military discovered that it couldn't control a black ghetto army, that these heavily black units saw themselves as guardians of the black population and not as occupiers. And that meant that the elite units of the U.S. Army could not be depended on to carry out counterinsurgency duty in U.S. cities. And that in turn meant the militarization of the police would have to be accelerated.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to understand the connection there. That black ghetto army was also not cooperating with the war managers in Vietnam either. They refused to offer themselves up as cannon fodder. And when they filled up the military prisons in Vietnam with black soldiers, the black soldiers burned the prisons down.
Yeah.
Now, I'm telling you these stories because that's the usefulness of elders. We remember things. The anti-war movement of that era thinks that they defeated the draft. And certainly the civilian mass movement was a huge factor in getting rid of mass conscription. But after 1968, the Joint Chiefs of the U.S. Armed Forces were already despairing about the usefulness of a draft army that wound up filling elite units like my 82nd Airborne Division with majorities of black soldiers, young black men with guns who refused to be counterinsurgency killers either at home or abroad. That would just not do. They had to make that change. If you tried to reinstate the draft today, it would be the top military brass that would be the most vocal opponents of the draft. They love the all-volunteer army. Ashton Carter, who was Obama's defense secretary, said they love the all-volunteer military because they get to pick who serves in it. And today, my old paratrooper unit, the 82nd, which was 60% black back in 1968, is the whitest unit in the whole U.S. Army. That is by design. Blacks still make up a disproportionate share of the Army, about 20%, but they're clustered in support units, driving trucks, supply units, things like that. They keep them away as much as possible from the combat arms. The super elite troops of the Special Operations Command are overwhelmingly white, and that is by design. Those troops now number 80,000 strong, and that's almost as large as the entire French army. Those are the mobile killers that the U.S. deploys around the world to snuff out insurgency against the empire. Those are the units that have swarmed all across the African continent, largely in secret, killing people in countries that they can't even locate on a map and can't even pronounce the names of.
Right.
And when they are killed, it's a surprise to the folks back home who didn't even know that the U.S. had troops in Niger until four Special Forces soldiers got killed there. How many Africans these killer elites slaughter is a secret, except, of course, to the Africans themselves, their families and friends, who know full well that the United States is waging multiple wars on the African continent, all of them in secret. It's also a secret to the Congressional Black Caucus, because the Congressional Black Caucus does not want to know.
That's right.
This is a caucus that calls itself the conscience of the Congress, but has hardly raised a peep over the last 25 years as 6 million Congolese have been slaughtered. It is the greatest genocide since World War II. And it gets bigger every day. It is still ongoing. In raw numbers, it now surpasses the murder of Jews by Hitler in World War II. And these 6 million have died because of invasions of the Congo by regimes that have been armed to the teeth by the United States. I'm talking about Rwanda and Uganda. After 25 years of genocide, one can only conclude that these killers are doing the bidding of the United States, which finances them and gives them their guns and their bullets, and also protects them in the United Nations. But the Congressional Black Caucus has taken no effective position on the Congo genocide. They've had 25 years to do so, and they have said nothing. Why? Because the U.S. government wants them to be silent.
That's right.
They can talk about Darfur and the repression of folks in South Sudan before independence because the U.S. opposed the Sudanese government. So that's all right for the Congressional Black Caucus to talk about. But they will not condemn genocidal regimes in Rwanda and Uganda because those are U.S. allies, and 6 million Congolese mean nothing to that caucus. For that and a host of reasons, that's why the Black Alliance for Peace gathered thousands of signatures on a petition demanding, one, complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa, two, the demilitarization of the African continent, three, the closure of U.S. bases throughout the world, not just in Africa, but everywhere, and four, demand that the Black Caucus oppose AFRICOM and that it conduct hearings into AFRICOM's impact on the African continent. We shall see what impact that petition has on the Black members of Congress. There are now more than 50 of them, but it seems that the more there are, the worse they get.
It's true.
Back in 2011, after President Obama had been bombing Libya for nearly half a year, killing tens of thousands of people, a bill was moved through Congress to halt that bombing and to recognize the authority of the War Powers Act, which was in force. Half of the Congressional Black Caucus voted to continue the bombing. Even an unprovoked attack on an African nation is not enough to move the Congressional Black Caucus. Obama said that the War Powers Act was not relevant because the attack on Libya was not a war at all, and it was not a war at all because no Americans had been killed. And so the first Black president made history with a new doctrine, an Obama doctrine. And that doctrine says that wars only exist when Americans are killed. And if the U.S. can kill thousands of people with bombs and with drones without suffering any of its own casualties, then that's not a war at all. That's not even hostilities. And the Congressional Black Caucus let him get away with that. So much for international law. Long before there was a Donald Trump in the White House, the United States has claimed immunity from international law. But international law is also United States law. That is the law. All treaties that have been ratified by the U.S. Congress have the force of law in the United States. And Obama was snubbing that law, the War Powers Act. Therefore, it is U.S. lawmakers that should have been most upset at the snubbing of law. And Black lawmakers should have been even more angry at the attack on an African nation, but that didn't faze them. By the summer of 2011, the NATO war against Libya was already destabilizing the whole northern tier of the African continent. But the Black Caucus, which calls itself the conscience of the Congress, continued with business as usual. Most of us have no illusions about politicians of the two corporate parties. But what about the Black masses? That's what we ought to be thinking about. Why do they allow their representatives to embrace war and to ignore the genocide of Africans? Aren't Black Americans historically the most left-leaning anti-war constituency in the country? Many of us have been saying that for a very long time. And it is true, they are the most left-leaning anti-war constituency in the country. Every poll has shown this, and they've shown this ever since Black people have been counted in the polls. Black people have historically opposed U.S. military adventures overseas, and they have especially opposed U.S. military adventures in countries of darker peoples. And the reason is because Black folks have always been skeptical of the motives of the United States, because we know what evil this country is capable of,
yes,
and we know it because it's done all those evils to us.
Right.
Just as importantly, Black Americans see the victims of U.S. foreign policy as people in ways that it appears most white Americans do not. And I'm going to give you the best example that I have to show this. In the weeks before the U.S. invaded Iraq back in 2003, the Zogby polling organization did a survey of public opinion, and they found that only 23% of Blacks supported an invasion of Iraq versus 62% of whites. 64% of Black folks said that they were strongly opposed to an attack on Iraq. And those are impressive anti-war figures. But then Zogby asked another question, and it went like this. Would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of civilians? Only 7% of Black folks said yes. And that is amazing. Only single digits of Black America wanted to pursue a war that would kill thousands of civilians. That, I think, is a Black consensus for peace that was registered right before the Iraq War. But a solid majority of white men said, yes, I don't mind the deaths of Iraqi civilians. And about a third of white women said that they were okay with that too. Only about 16% of Hispanics were thirsty for Iraqi civilian blood. Those numbers from 2003 show that there is a world of difference, a world view of difference between Black and white America on issues of peace. Virtually nobody Black wanted to kill Iraqi civilians. Black people really are fundamentally anti-war. But then Obama happened. And Black people were suddenly more tolerant of war under a Black commander-in-chief. In August of 2013, President Obama was threatening to bomb Syria, supposedly in retaliation for a poison gas attack. Subsequent investigations show that the Syrian military could not have carried out that attack. But Obama had already drawn what people were calling a line in the sand, so he was preparing to attack. The Washington Post and ABC conducted a poll in the week before that planned attack, and that poll found that 40% of Black people supported Obama's threat of airstrikes against Syria. Only 38% of whites supported bombing Syria, and just 31% of Hispanics felt that way. That is, Blacks were 2% more in favor of bombing than white people were. Now, majorities of all Americans at that time, during that week, were opposed to bombing, and Obama then was forced to call off his attack. Only minorities of all ethnicities were in favor of bombing. I want to make that clear. But this still was the first time in polling history that Blacks were more in favor of war than whites were. This is Obama time. And that tells us something about the imperative to Black unity. The imperative to Black unity has served us well through most of our history in the United States. But under certain circumstances, that imperative can make us as dangerous to the world as white Americans are dangerous to the world if we extend that unity to warmongering black politicians. The Congressional Black Caucus certainly has no solidarity with black people, but it does love the cops, and it loves the Pentagon's weapons, and I'll show you how. In 2014, just 2 months before Mike Brown was shot down in Ferguson, Missouri, the U.S. Congress had a chance to vote on a bill that would have halted the Pentagon's infamous 1033 program.
That's right.
That's the program that funnels billions of battlefield-grade weapons and military gear into local police departments. When the Grayson Amendment came up for a vote, 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus voted against it. That means 4 out of every 5 black congresspersons voted for continued militarization of the police. They did so because Obama loved it. And Obama multiplied the 1033's funneling of weapons to local police 2,700%. Not long after that vote, Ferguson went up in flames, and the Black Lives Matter movement emerged. It was a national phenomenon, the first blush of a mass movement, black mass movement, in 2 generations. And you would think that such a phenomenon would have an effect on the Congressional Black Caucus. I know it had an effect of a kind on the Democratic Party because they tried to co-opt it.
That's right. Yeah.
But in terms of the caucus, last year, 75% of the caucus, that's 3 out of 4 of them, voted to make the police a protected class.
Yeah.
That means if you hit a policeman, it is treated as a hate crime.
That's right.
With extra time in prison added. And we all know when the police kick your ass, they charge you with hitting them.
That's right. That's right.
So on top of all the other impunities bestowed on the cops, they are now given protected class status. With the overwhelming assent of the Congressional Black Caucus, which has no conscience and no loyalty to the black community. So, what is our job in the Black Alliance for Peace? It is not primarily just to darken up those 2 white anti-war marches, although there is a need to darken up those 2 white anti-war marches. But what we must do is tap into the historical and real pro-peace sentiments of our people and help them disentangle themselves from false leaders and jive politicians that care more for the police and the Pentagon than for their own people, and who are unmoved by the slaughter of 6 million Africans. Such people are unworthy of us. So we are going to embarrass them first and then move them out of office with all deliberate speed.
Yes.
The people of Congo demand it. Power to the people.
Power.